This is Icon Art Radio, and here we are in the Icon Gallery in the town square of Fairfield. Donna Colby, Alan Cobb, and myself, Bill Teeple. All right, one more quote from Donna.
Yes,
this is Matisse.
Yeah, this is the third show we're doing in a row, sparked by these quotes that I came across in preparing for the course I've been teaching on color. And this one by Matisse, he says, "The chief function of color should be to serve expression as well as possible. I put down my tones without a preconceived plan. The expressive aspect of color imposes itself on me in a purely instinctive way. To paint an autumn landscape, I will not try to remember what colors suit this season. I will be inspired only by the sensation that the season arouses in me. The icy purity of the sour blue sky will express the season just as well as the nuances of foliage. My sensation itself may vary. The autumn may be soft and warm, like a continuation of summer, or quite cool with a cold sky and lemon yellow trees that give a chilly impression and already announce winter." So it's a good transition from our last show where we talked a lot about autumn, and it also relates to one thing that's been important to me in teaching the people in this color class that I've been teaching, is to begin in the first two lessons especially to help people to have an innocent relationship to color and to forget all that they've learned before about color theory or about what they thought was their favorite color or fashionable colors. There are social class kind of color associations. There are cultural associations with color. And if we forget all that, if we can forget all that and innocently relate to color, we can get to this place where that Matisse was describing in this quote, where you actually have an immediate response, an innocent and spontaneous response to certain colors. So the students in my class have had many exercises where they've looked at pictures of color combinations or particular color palettes or individual colors, many pictures that are all primarily red, many pictures then that are all primarily yellow or going through all the colors, to really see what those innocent responses are to color. And the people are discovering how dramatic those natural reactions really are, especially when we dealt with individual colors. But even with color combinations, I gave them assignments to come to the next class wearing color combinations that they may not have chosen before, but now in light of tuning into color a little bit more, seeing that, oh, this is a very interesting combination with this. And as often when you give assignments like that to people in the classes a week later, people kind of forget about it and don't do it. But they arrived in yesterday's class, and every person in the class was dressed in a really interesting color combination, not necessarily characteristic of the way that they usually dress. And it was delightful, and they were reveling in it, in this discovery of being more awake to color in their everyday life.
Well, I remember when I was younger, much younger, not a kid, but I was more like inquiring into the nature of everything. And I suddenly saw the world as a color world, because you sort of like are so focused in on the stuff and its meaning and the story of your life and all, that you sort of take for granted that you're living inside a painting that's all made out of color. I mean, it's just like unbelievable. Mm. But that was quite an awakening for me. I mean, it was apart from other stimulations that brought it to my attention.
Right, yeah.
Just before that, I had had this experience of, it's a color world. I mean, it's just like you're inside a painting. You're looking at it like a painting that's full of color. And the world is never quite the same when that kind of comes to you.
Well, and that's one reason why going to art museums is so valuable, because when you bathe yourself in this amazingly awake relationship to color that these artists had when they did these paintings, and you walk through and you take in all of this wonderful dance of color and form and all that, and then you go outside and you walk on the street, you can be in the most drab city and find yourself looking at everything like a beautiful work of art, because your vision has been cultured spontaneously by...
Yeah, I had a wonderful experience. I was living up at Lake Tahoe, and I bought this software package which is designed for constructing a 3D virtual model in the computer of a landscape. Mm-hmm. It's called Bryce, after Bryce Canyon. And it's a very sophisticated program. It uses ray tracing, so that you really, as you build things, you then, in a sense, position the camera in this virtual scene, and it takes a very, very realistic high-resolution picture of the scene as it would look if you were actually putting a camera in that position in an actual scene. And it has facilities for clouds and skies and sky lighting, and you can move the sun around to where it needs to be, and it's got rocks and trees and things you can put in it, and terrains and bodies of water and ground planes, and then all these rich textures and complex surfaces that go on stuff to make things look realistic. And it's astonishingly realistic. And so I was fascinated by it. It was, you know, my equivalent of a video game, and I played with it and constructed worlds and environments in it for a couple of weeks, pretty ferociously. And the first couple of days I had it, I had been just, you know, blowing my mind with all of its capabilities and seeing what's involved in building a landscape. And then after a few hours of, you know, deeply exploring this program, we hopped in the car and drove halfway around Lake Tahoe and over the mountains to the village of Truckee. And here we are in the Sierra Nevadas, you know, and winter was coming on, and there were patches of snow in the mountains and still some green showing here and there, and all the trees and shapes and skies and clouds and details. Mm-hmm. And everything that I looked at, I found myself thinking, wow, that's really well done. That is especially good. You know, I don't know, wow, how would you do those clouds? You know, that's, I don't think I can do those clouds with these tools. And it lasted for quite a long time. Every time I played with that, I went outside, I saw all the colors as colors, and not just as the way things happened to be. Hmm. And I saw all the shapes as shapes that, you know, had to be made. And everything was deliberate. And it was wonderful. It completely transformed the way I was able to see things. And especially natural things, which is sort of the ultimate irony, because what had stimulated this appreciation of nature was something that, as artificial as it gets.
But that's sort of like what we were talking about last week when we were talking about the being in your studio and feeling kind of the same delight as a nature spirit probably feels, you know, creating some details of some elements of nature. You know, it's that it's that original creative process that, even though it was evoked in you from this computer program, it's still that same process of moving the light this way and making the colors more saturated or less saturated, and, you know, changing the forms and the size relationship and all of that. It's a primal, marvelous principle of nature that
if God created us in His own image, then, you know, here we are in our own tiny way, you know, trying to be God.
When you've been teaching this class now for some weeks, are your students describing to you a transformation in the way that they see the world as a result
of definitely.
Having been in there and you're placing the attention?
We, in fact, that's what we do at the beginning of each session, is everyone tells about how their relation to color differed, you know, during that week. And the assignments have been, in the first lesson was completely just kind of innocent response to color without much information. And that was when they came back at the second class, they said, oh yes, they noticed everywhere they went, they just noticed color more. The second class was on color combinations and the complementary colors and particular limited palettes that various artists have used. And that's what they were, this assignment was, see what you notice as you go out and about, you know, about relationships to colors. And it actually worked. They came back and said, oh yeah, I noticed that when this purple was against this yellow in this flower, you know, it was absolutely unbelievable. They noticed in certain buildings that they went into that there were certain color combinations that just made them feel warm and cozy, and other color combinations that put them off in some way. And but everyone has, the response from everyone has been that they have noticed color more and have become more daring in their own homes in the use of color. You know, one woman in the class, she was looking through a book. There are these marvelous books by a designer named Tricia Guild. She was British, I think. And her design sense, you know, was highly saturated colors in amazing combinations. And the books that she put out back in the 80s or 90s when she was in her heyday, they're just like filled with amazing colors. And so this woman was looking in the class, was looking through one of those books in the first class, and there was a bowl, I think it was like a royal blue bowl filled with limes. And she literally almost shrieked when she came to that picture, and she just said, I just realized in looking at this picture that's so beautiful and I love looking at it, I just realized that I could just get a bowl and put some limes on my table as an art piece. And it was something she really hadn't thought of doing before, you know, if she wasn't serving them for a meal or something like that. And it opened up a whole world for her of possibilities, of easy ways to bring color into your life without having to be a painter, without having to spend a lot of money on an art object. You can put together colors in all these innocent ways and play with them. The other thing is, I've been holding these classes in my house, and one thing that I learned in my house responding to seasons, in the last show we talked about the seasons, and I always had the desire to have a house that I could change the decor according to the seasons. But it always seemed so elaborate, you know, slip covers for the furniture and new curtains and new rugs, you know, and expensive and tedious, and so I never actually did it. But this year, somebody came over in the spring, and when I had this desire to revamp the colors in my house, and brought a whole pile of blankets, sheets, towels, all these things in many different colors, and we just draped them everywhere to see what colors I really wanted to be surrounded by in the spring. And once I figured it out, which colors worked in which room, I realized that I could do that myself. I could go to the fabric store and just buy a piece of fabric and wrap it around a pillow. I didn't even have to sew it into a pillowcase. I could get a quilt and just some inexpensive quilt and drape it on my sofa instead of buying a fully made slipcover, and it would add that color for the season. I could hang ribbons on the tops of my curtains to add color to it instead of having to get all new curtains. And so my house has become a color project, like a painting in itself, with these very inexpensive and easy ways to bring new colors into the rooms on a regular basis.
And it has to be a response to your inner need for these qualities around you.
Right.
At different times of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Wagner used to hang all these colored silks all around for when he, in his home, when he was composing.
Well, and in the Waldorf schools that Rudolf Steiner started, the children play with colored silks. big pieces of colored silk that they wear as costumes, or they make little houses out of them and all of that. And it's an essential part of their education is to learn to relate to these pure fields of color.
And there was a point when I wasn't really thinking of myself as so much a card-carrying member of the art world, but it was just what I was.
They have cards?
Well, you get an MFA and you get one, I think, and there's various sort of dues you pay and you get one, and I haven't seen them, but I've seen what they do to people when you become one. But I was actually sort of caregiving. My sister was ill. My father, I had this kind of illness in the family, various kinds of things, so I had to be there sort of caregiving. But I would carve out a little time for myself every day. And so I wasn't thinking of myself as an artist so much as I was, well, I was actually making the little drawings still. That was my art still. I was making little drawings. But this other thing was playing with color. And I didn't like the idea of thinking of them as paintings or as commodities, art commodities, or products, but just I wanted to feel what I felt about color. And I loved those sessions because I would just do, I pretty much mostly dealt with blue because that's where I was at that time. And then I came here to Fairfield a decade ago, and I was still on that wave of playing with these colors. I went into red-orange, a whole new mode. My whole life changed at that point. I became much more outward and embracing of the world. I was more pulled back and inward in the blue period. But in any case, I was not thinking of art product at all. I was thinking blueness. I wanted to get inside of blueness. I wanted to get inside of orangeness. Mm-hmm. And there were other colors. I was experiencing pink and yellow and just experience what I experienced. And I felt like these were my friends. I felt like each color was that friend. Mm-hmm. It was a very wonderful time in my life.
Well, and
I still feel that way. I mean, it still has extended into my being really more in the middle of this art scene, we might call it, that we live in.
I
sort of cherished keeping the colors, that relationship to color, and even art and form and moving it, actually.
Well, and when you said, you know, you're blue, you went through a period where you're delving into blueness and blue is your friend and then a different color. I think it's interesting that at different times in our lives, we have different favorite colors and different whole palettes that we completely relate to. I remember during the time when I was a mother, I was very infatuated with blue, and I pretty much wore blue and white constantly, probably because they were very, that was a calming color for the unpredictable world of being a mother of young children, maybe. At this point in my life, I can't get enough yellows and oranges and really beautiful, highly saturated, warm colors, and also colors like turquoise and royal blue, and again, very saturated colors. And for me, it was a kind of a breakthrough when I became friends with Duncan McMaster, he's known as a woodworker in town, but he also has an amazing relationship to color and color relationships. And he introduced me to certain color combinations that I hadn't really been daring enough to try before, and that was a wonderful thing. And there, many of those color combinations are primarily common in Asian countries more than they are in Western countries. Everyone knows when you see pictures of India, or Thailand, or Bali, or some place like that, they're very photogenic countries because the colors are so intense and saturated and combined in such bold, beautiful ways. In our culture, if somebody painted a house in those colors, you know, you go traveling and you look at houses or garments in those colors and you say, oh, isn't that wonderful? But you don't necessarily come home and dress that way or paint your house in those colors because you don't want your neighbors to think that you're just wild. But why is that? You know, I started to question that notion, and, you know, why do we have the color prejudices that we have, or the color snobbery even that we have in our culture? And so I think in teaching this color class, that's another thing that we're exploring, is why we feel like we can't use certain colors. Certain colors are forbidden because they're too wild or whatever. Where when we travel, we see those colors and they thrill us deeply to the core.
Were you going to run with that one, Alan?
Well, I was reflecting on one time when I went to Flax's in L.A. I picked up a bottle of some kind of opalescent acrylic, and there were a couple of other people buying paints next to me, and one of them looked over and made this very disdainful comment about using these, you know, hobby paints. And I thought, hobby paints, eh? And so I bought every single metal flake and opalescent and, you know, weirdly adulterated color that they had. I mean, I spent about $300 on these little bottles of wonderfully weird and interesting paints. And then I became so infatuated with the weird and interesting qualities of the paints that I barely dared to use them for anything. But I did use them, and there's only one little thing left, which you've seen, one of those little squares. But they're fantastic. You know, you're creating a different surface. It's not an oil painting or an acrylic painting surface. It's a different one. And there's nothing wrong with it at all.
Right. There is, if you're prejudiced.
Well, of course.
This is a show unto itself that we may have to approach at some point. But there's like unbelievable prejudice in the art world in terms of trying to organize yourselves in some kind of hierarchy.
Yeah.
And you're trying to move up the ladder of that hierarchy. And none of this has anything to do with what we just described earlier as this experience, this mature experience of allowing creative intelligence to play in itself through you to create art, which is the mature level of the fine artist. But this other thing, because see, now this opalescent paints, this must have been how long ago?
Probably eight years ago, early 90s.
Early 90s, okay, well, yeah, I mean, for a serious artist to use opalescent paint was like a serious no-no, but it's actually become much more fashionable today.
Yeah.
People have not been afraid. Some guy at some point that was sort of cool decided it was okay to play with it.
Yeah. Well, I remember when Andy Potok started losing his vision in Vermont, a painter friend of mine, and he started including Day-Glo colors in his palette paintings. And he was a master of color, and they really worked. They worked fine. You didn't know you were looking at Day-Glo paint. And of course, they fade really fast, so that's a problem. But, you know, he would do these paintings, and you'd just look at them and think, God, how does he do that? And there was never any sense that he was using trickery or some cheap gimmick or something like that. These were sophisticated, you know, figure studies done with a large palette knife and a very, very refined sense of color. And some of the colors happened to be brighter than regular pigments. And that's all. And they got mixed with other colors, and you couldn't tell where the Day-Glo began and where it left off. But they were just wonderful paintings, and he was breaking the rules.
But then isn't that fun? There's always going to be someone who says, "Hey, wait a minute, that's stupid.
Yeah.
If I want to use this, I'm going to." And then
they
just have enough self-confidence to go.
Well, I appreciated the fact that this guy had put down the paint. I mean, I was thinking, how can you put down a color or a texture? Or, I mean, it's like completely meaningless to judge a color. It's insane. I mean, it boggles my mind.
Well, and there's so many cultural aspects that play into all of this too, like periods of time in history, mm-hmm. in fashion and art, when all of the colors were muted, boring. Now here, yeah. I am judging them in, yeah. myself, you know, colors that where people were really, in a sense, frightened of bright colors. And possibly it was a time, I mean, probably it was a time in history when people really very consciously wanted to control life, make it predictable, make it subdued, you know, and didn't want anything.
Don't stand out.
Yeah, nothing to stimulate anything boundary breaking. Because what they wanted to do was create boundaries that they could live by and, you know, kind of make as fundamentals of life. And so having this tiny little limited palette of colors that everybody was supposed to wear possibly fit into that and paint their houses and all that, it sort of made life simpler for those, yeah. cultures.
Well, I remember at the time thinking this guy who made the comment about the hobby paints, thinking his necktie was much too wide.
Yes, we're always putting down people who are judgmental and then judging them.
Absolutely, so. Yeah. So there's no better way to put down
judgmental
someone.
People.
Right. Judgmental people are really stupid.
They all ought to be banned.
Right.
Then we'd have a beautiful age. how we slip into these patterns, but it's pattern, it's once again, it's patterns.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We slip into these patterns, and people are trying to find comfortable niches. It seems to me that the pursuit of the human model is to move through change through stable niches.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just normal. If we don't, I don't think we could progress. So yeah. Those stable niches, those periods of conservatism, we might say, are kind of absolute. I mean, they're sort of like the goal.
And then they have to be crashed through.
And then they have to be crashed through. Yeah.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.